All right. Luke chapter 16. And we're about to wrap up the parable of the dishonest manager. And let's keep in mind here as we conclude this, the last few verses of this, that obviously Jesus is commending this dishonest manager or steward, but we got to keep in mind he's only commending him for his prudence. And that's it. A lot of people make a big deal out about this, and some people really struggle with this parable because it sounds as if he is commending a dishonest act, what would really be an unrighteous act, but that's not what he's doing at all. He's just teaching us that we ought to be prudent, and we ought to use the things at our the resources that we have, just like he did his. Now, he was a dishonest man, and so it's an illustration of him doing something dishonest, but he was prudent. He was in a desperate situation, and he very quickly thought about what he could do to help himself, and then he executed it. And so he's saying we ought to do the same, even when it comes down to what the record refers to as unrighteous wealth. We ought to use, he's just referring to money and material things there. And remember, he describes it as unrighteous just because there's inherent danger involved in wealth. There just is. There's no way to get around that. There's temptation with wealth. It doesn't mean that anyone who is wealthy is sinful or anything like that. It's just there's the temptation of putting money before God if you have it. There's the temptation of putting money before God if you're just striving to get it. Whatever your situation is, of becoming materialistic, of pride that can be involved, and maybe thinking you're better than someone else because you have a lot of it, whatever, the list goes on, of things that are just sort of inherently involved in wealth, and so we just have to work hard, whatever situation we're in, not to allow money or mammon to be more important than God, or to corrupt our thinking and our treatment of other people. But so he just uses that terminology there because of those inherent things. And so he says that we ought to make friends of unrighteous wealth. And he's just saying, use it. Just be like the prudent man, the dishonest man. Use it wisely. Now, we're not dishonest, or we shouldn't be. We better not be dishonest or unrighteous. So we'll use it in a way that glorifies God. We'll use it in a way that can help others. And but we need to be wise with regard to that. I have three notes that I just put in my Bible here that we can applications. Use money to win others to Christ is a good way of using unrighteous wealth wisely. Using mammon wisely. And so, and you could give many other examples of that. If one doesn't use his money, the unhealthy riches wisely, well, why would we expect for God to give us the better, more important riches, the spiritual riches? And so that's where Jesus gets to talking at verse 10. The one who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much. And the one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. And so we need to show, we need to prove ourselves that we can deal with the blessings that God wants to bestow upon us. And then you get down to verse 13 even, that's a familiar verse, though usually we find this, of course, in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God in mammon. So with regard to using money wisely, that, of course, is making sure that we are the ones that are mastering that wealth instead of the other way around. And there's a lot of good lessons here. Notice the scope of this. No servant can serve two masters. Does that mean almost no servant? No. You think, no. Think, well, you know, not too many people could do it, but I think I can serve two masters. No, you can't. You can't do that. Now, he's talking about two masters that are diametrically opposed to each other. Like, it is possible to serve two masters at the same time. Give me an example of that. Huh? All right. You can obey the government as long as what? As long as the laws aren't contrary to the laws of God. Now, sometimes with regard to government, there might be an issue with that, particularly in Paul's day or in the first century. But generally speaking, we can keep the laws of the land and be good citizens. We talked about that last Sunday morning in the sermon. God expects us of that. That's Romans 13. Like, God commands that we obey the laws of the land. We can do that and obey God at the same time unless there's a conflict. And so, you know, there's other things we can talk about. Are wives to submit to their own husbands? Can they do that and submit to God at the same time? Yes. You can make the illustration of employment. There's a lot of ways in which you can be under the authority of more than one person at the same time. But you can't be under the authority of two people that are opposed to each other, two things that are opposed to each other. God and mammon are opposed to each other. God says, put me first. Mammon says what? Put me first. You can't do both of those at the same time. You have to make a choice. And so we understand then that's what Jesus is talking about. In that realm where you have two masters, that are opposed to each other, you have to make a decision. And so no servant can serve two masters, for either, and he even explains, either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. And so again, you cannot, and he's decisive about that, you cannot serve God and mammon. Don't even try, because you can't. It's impossible. So the lesson is, put God first. God didn't want you said, okay, I can't serve both, so I guess I'll serve mammon. No, that will lose your salvation. Serve God, put him first always. And don't allow the pursuit of mammon, the pursuit of wealth, to get the best of you. All right, then we get down to verse 14, and he says the Pharisees who were lovers of money. Now, Pharisees had all kind of problems, didn't they? But they were lovers of money. They were covetous. So as a result of that, it says when they heard all these things, they ridiculed him. Like, they're sitting here listening to all that we just study on this parable of the unrighteous steward, and they didn't like it because they weren't they felt indicted by what Jesus was saying. So the ESV says, they ridiculed him. What does another translation say? They scoffed at him. That's probably a better translation there. They scoffed at him. Because one thing, when you're covetous, and we've seen this on Wednesday night with the Jews of the Old Testament time, you think that you're in favor with God because of all that you have. And there's a lot of people that have a religious inclination that if you don't have a religious inclination, you don't think about God at all. But if you do and you have wealth, you just conclude, this is because God has blessed me. And that might be true. Does God bless us materially? Yes, absolutely he does. But he doesn't bless us materially if we're living in sin. I mean, we don't, that's not, God is not going to bless us when we're breaking his law. And yet some people think that's evidence that I'm right with God because I have the, you know, I got a promotion on the job. Yeah, you're living in sin, but I got a promotion. That means I'm in favor with God. And that's kind of how the Pharisees felt. They were covetous. And so when they hear Jesus teaching on mammon and thing, they kind of, the Greek word there means to turn your nose up. So scoff is kind of bad, but that they hear that teaching, so, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. We're in favor with God. We know it because of the material things that we have. So they scoffed at him, but Jesus, of course, knows the hearts of men, doesn't he? So he knew exactly what was on their minds. So he responded to it. He said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves before men," which again, that could be a problem for all of us. But they thought, you know, everybody thought the Pharisees were the religious elite and all of that, and they might look at man might look at their wealth and conclude, oh yeah, they are the religious elite. Look how God has shown favor towards them. But Jesus emphasizes that the heart is far more important than that. He says, "You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God." So man, does man, even in the world that we live in, do they exalt and look favorably upon things like wealth? Yes. Like the person who's wealthy, it's amazing who will listen to them. Like people, just because they might be multimillionaires, and then all of a sudden they're experts on everything to common people. They can, and sometimes they do, they can make statements about religion, sometimes about certain aspects of the Bible. And because they're highly successful in the secular realm and very wealthy and, you know, heads of CEOs of multi-million dollar companies and stuff, whatever they talk about, people just say, oh, that's right, that's right. And usually, guess what? They don't have a clue what they're talking about. And whatever they conclude is the opposite of what the Bible teaches. And so it may be exalted among men, but it's an abomination to God. And so that's a summary sort of the Pharisees as a whole in the life that they were living. Like everybody looked up. You can imagine the disciples of Christ when he was saying things like in the Sermon on the Mount, your righteousness has to exceed that of the Pharisees. That would be shocking to them. Like, not only do you have to be as righteous as the Pharisees, you have to be more righteous. You have to have a better righteousness than the Pharisees. You mean the religious elite? Are we talking about the same people? Yeah, of course. Because their righteousness was only outward as they were perceived by man, not by God. So, yes.
We talk about and think about and have heard all my life, free will. My family is free will Baptist, they call it.
Yeah.
But God allows that. We have a free will. If we want to go after wealth, God's not going to stop us.
Right.
So it's a choice that we make. God's not making that choice for us.
Right.
You know, if he wants to, if we want to be a drunk, we can be a drunk.
Right.
But if we want to be a gospel preacher, we can be a gospel preacher.
Right.
Yeah, and so it's up to us. There's where the judgment on our part comes in.
Yeah.
We make the judgment as to what we're going to do and how we're going to do it.
Right. And when it comes down to wealth, I like the way you put that with wealth. Like if you go after wealth, that's the thing that's a problem. Like none of us in here who are Christians, if you're a citizen of the kingdom of God, you shouldn't be pursuing wealth. That should not be your pursuit in life. Remember Paul in 1 Timothy 6, he talked about the desire to be rich. It's not being rich. Like, you just live your life and God may bless you. And the fact of the matter is, when you live a good life and you have a good job and you're faithful, a good employer, it's very possible you can accumulate wealth. But that's not your pursuit in life. Once that becomes your pursuit in life, something or someone's going to have to take a back seat to that. And who usually takes the back seat? God. And so I like the way Dale put that. If you're going after wealth, if that's what your pursuit is in life, then it's not going to end well from a spiritual standpoint. And so we have to know who we are and what we're about. I often say, like Paul, I mean, he was a tent maker. But that was just his occupation. It wasn't who he was. He was a Christian first and put that first. Yeah. Yes.
We all, as Christians, know the prime example that Jesus gave and stuff when the devil tempted him. He said, if you bow down to me, I'll give you the whole world.
Yeah.
Everything in it.
Right.
And a lot of times in my life and stuff, I've seen it. I haven't been there, but I've seen it to where, like you were saying, Don, that people actually think that because they get wealth and stuff, that it comes from the Lord. And a lot of times that can come from Satan. Because of the fact that he wants to try to trip, that's one way he's got to try to trip people up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, uses that, you know, for his good.
Right.
To try to get people off track.
Sure.
Get them away from Christianity and stuff, because money has a lot to do with, you know, it gives people the feeling of power.
Right. Right.
And if he would have done that, there probably wouldn't have been no chance for us.
Yes.
Because
If he would have got Jesus to sin,
right,
the game would have been over. That's it. And so, like, even in that temptation, he wasn't trying to get Jesus to say, okay, I'm your new master. All he needed was for Jesus to bow one time. That's kind of the way the devil, how he approaches us. You don't have to give your whole life to me. Just once. Just put me before God one time. And now, you know, he has the advantage. And so we have to be weary of that. So, all right. But so he goes on to say here, but that's kind of a scary thought, right? God knows your heart. I mean, we should always keep that in mind every day, everything that we do, all the decisions we make. Outwardly, we don't, you know, people, you don't know my heart, and you only by the fruit that I bear. But that can be deceptive, at least for a while. But not with God. He knows instantly everything about, because he knows our heart. So that can be frightening, or it can actually even be comforting if you're living the way you ought to be living. And so it should have frightened the Pharisees, of course, a lot. But the God knows their heart. And then he said, verse 16, he says, there's a little some difficulty here in verse 16. The first part's easy. He says, the law and the prophets were until John, that is John the Baptist. Since then, the good news of the kingdom of God is preached. And so we understand that. When he talks about the law and the prophets there, that's just meant to be the Old Testament as a whole, and we know that Old Testament law, how long it lasted until Jesus came in those days, and then even Jesus began to preach the kingdom, and we have evidence, Matthew 4:17, other places where Jesus began to preach the good news of the kingdom. But here's the thing. It was still, he came and he was introducing it. It was preparatory. And then, of course, we know on the day of Pentecost, and the gospel was preached for the first time, and the doors of the kingdom were unlocked. Peter received the keys of the kingdom to heaven, and he used those keys in that first sermon on the day of Pentecost. So all that time in between was preparatory. And that might explain the next statement. That is a little bit difficult there. He says, and everyone forces his way into it. And scholars have a field day. They're all over the map with that. What does that mean? And some look at it from a positive standpoint, that and different translations use different words. But the Greek word literally means violently. So again, some translations, I think the King James uses the word press. I think presses. I might be wrong about that, but I think uses the word press. And so some take the position, what he is saying is that when the kingdom began to be preached, then people with zeal and enthusiasm would enter into the kingdom at the appropriate time. But again, the problem with that is the Greek word does literally mean violent. So J.W. McGarvey looks at it from a negative standpoint and kind of views this like we have passages. You remember when Jesus, during his personal ministry, people try to force him to be king. And he kind of goes down that road, that in that preparatory time, that people were trying to get into the kingdom and force the kingdom to be a reality. And a lot of that was their misunderstanding of the kingdom and the nature of the kingdom. Because how do these Jews, the ones that Jesus are talking about, how do they view the kingdom at this point? What do they think the kingdom was going to be? An earthly physical kingdom. So we're going to take Jesus, force him to be king, and set up this kingdom right now, and we're going to be released from this Roman yoke and all of that. And they try to force it. And so that could very well be what Jesus is referring to here. It's difficult. I'm not 100% sure of what he meant there, but that would make sense. The other position, it could be figurative. So again, the Greek word does mean violently, but we're not going to lose sleep over that. And if Jesus was just being figurative and using it from a positive standpoint, but we do know that the law and the prophets were coming to an end, and that the new covenant, the new dispensation, was about to be established and take over. So, all right, and then he says, but it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one dot of the law to become void, which we know that to be true. There's no problem with that. Jesus didn't come to destroy the law, did he? What did he come to do? To fulfill the law. Now, he did abolish it. And Ephesians 2, verse 14, talks about that. It's exactly what he did. Some translations, if I remember correctly, they use the word abolish. That he didn't come to abolish. Well, that's exactly what he did. So that's not a good translation if you have that translation. But he didn't come to destroy. Jesus didn't come to obliterate the law. He came to fulfill it. And when it was fulfilled, it was taken out of the way. It was nailed to the cross. But up to that point, every aspect of the law was intact and was meant to be fulfilled. Now, why does he say all that right here? Who wasn't fulfilling the law? The Pharisees. The very ones that were self-righteous. They had all kind of traditions that they had introduced that gave them loopholes around certain aspects of the law. And some of it they were just flat out ignoring. And that explains the next verse, that verse 18, that kind of seems out of place. Now, why did he throw this in there? Verse 18. Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. Now, on an aside, that's great teaching and one we need to pay attention to that a lot of people ignore. But that aside, why did he throw that in here? I'll tell you why. because the Pharisees, they were amongst the school that had a very loose view of marriage and divorce and remarriage. So you had some Jewish scholars who took a more scriptural stand about the sanctity of marriage, and then you had other scholars who were very popular who thought you could divorce your wife for any cause. That's why in Matthew chapter 19, you remember, they came to Jesus and asked that very question, can we put away our wife for any cause? Why? Because major scholars among them were teaching that. And the Pharisees were latching on to that. Well, that was the violation of Scripture. And so he's just giving them an example. You're so righteous. You think you're so righteous and holy and all that. But you don't keep a law. And one example of that is how you view marriage and divorce. And so, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had that. So other than that, that it kind of seems out of place. But that's why he threw that in there. Now, the teaching itself is very critical, isn't it? We understand that marriage is to last how long? For life, until your spouse dies. And we understand that the importance of that. And when that's violated and remarriage takes place, then there's adultery. And so we understand it's a very important teaching. But Jesus didn't put that there to open up that, thing. He was exposing the Pharisees for their hypocrisy, really. So, yeah, Jimmy. Right.
You know, why do we think 2,000 years later we still have to preach on marriage, divorce, remarriage?
Right.
Loopholes.
Yep.
We're going to try to come up with a way to come around God's authority to reason in our mind. We'll see the scriptures say this, and I'm going to reason in my mind why the scriptures say this.
Right.
And we don't only do it on this, but there's numerous subjects we could probably talk about.
Yes.
That we could be Pharisees, just as the Pharisees.
Yeah. Right. Right.
How things are that I'm going to take a loophole and I'm going to form the scriptures around my opinion, not form my opinion for what should be scriptural.
Yeah.
I'm going to take it, I'm going to wrap it around my opinion to make it correct.
Right. There's all kinds of things we can learn from the Pharisees. It's just all negative for the most part. We could look at the Pharisees, and again, that's why Jesus said your righteousness has to exceed theirs, because they were doing all those kind of things. But Jimmy's right. I could rattle off right now 5 or 6 different perversions of marriage, divorce, and remarriage set by man. And Jake.
That's how I interpreted the end of verse 16 is exactly how Jimmy said it. Everyone's forcing his way into it, and then he segues into not one stroke of the letter of the law will pass away. Everyone's trying to force their way.
No doubt. And with regard to the gospel, which of course is the law we're under today, but that's why we have denominationalism and all these things. So, all right. Anybody else? Yes, Dwayne. Scriptures did it. I didn't.
I wanted to shake the right hand. I wasn't even a Christian when I got married.
Yeah.
Why didn't I get married?
But we do. I think, again, Jimmy's right. We need to. It is broader. I mean, there's a lot of that going on. There's all kind of cases that I could tell you of. I've often maybe mentioned to you of one sister who came. She wanted to divorce her husband, and she'd come to me, I mean, over probably a 5-year span or so. Every once in a while, I mean, you know, 6 months might pass. And then, Don, what about this? And can this? You know, I got my. I think this. No, no, no. And so, trying to find loopholes. That's a problem. Jimmy and then Deb. Yeah.
We have to be careful of, you know, well, I don't like brother so-and-so, but I've reasoned in my mind through scriptures why I'm not allowed to like you, why I can
right.
hold bitterness, or I can hold something personal against you for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
But I've reasoned in my mind through the scriptures, God would want me to treat you this way.
Yeah.
And, that, you know, I don't want us to get hung up on just this marriage and divorce part itself, but it can be in every attitude of our lives.
Right. Right. I'm not sure there's a commandment God has given that somebody somewhere at some time hasn't tried to find a loophole around. So, yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about the Jews and what they and their divorce and all that. And I thought about Malachi 2 in verse 16, where God himself said, I hate divorce.
Right.
And so the Jews, just like a lot of us today, we want to get around everything. And they accuse Moses. It's Moses' fault. He let him do this.
Yeah.
But God himself said, I hate divorce. And the Jews had to know that. It came from a prophet.
Right.
They had to know that.
Yeah.
But they didn't pay attention to it.
Right.
And we find ourselves sometimes doing the same thing.
Yes. Got to pay attention to God's word. All right. So that's a pretty good. We have a few more moments. Anyone? We're about to hit a new section, the rich man and Lazarus. So we're familiar with that. But it's good to go over. That's important teaching again. So, anybody got anything about what we've talked about? All right. So, we'll just get started. The bell ring any minute here. But, again, just a wonderful teaching. I might spend a moment or two before the bell rings. People have argued forever about, well, now, what are we getting into here now? Is this a parable? Or is this a story? And I could get to a pack of papers about this thick on people arguing that when it really doesn't matter. What is a parable? Very good. Heavenly story, earthly meaning. And so, whatever. One thing we know is Jesus is not going to use a lie or an unscriptural thing, a perversion of the gospel, and put it into a parable as truth. So I don't care what you call this, if you call it a parable or just a story. There's things that take place in this parable that you don't see in other parables that lead some scholars to believe it's not a parable, it's just a story. But end of the day, it doesn't matter that much. Yeah, Steve.
Could have really happened, you know, they were, and I think about who's telling these stories, Jesus.
Yeah.
He witnessed everything from the beginning of time. He's the creator.
Right.
I suspect that he saw some of these things happen, mm-hmm. and he's relating them, the parable of this man that made friends with the earthly people, you know, making everything right. He probably witnessed that
right.
from heaven.
Yeah.
You know, at one point or another. To me, all of the parables almost could have really happened, and he's just relaying them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a good point that when you think about, you forget sometimes, we should never forget, but when we're going through this, you know, I've often said, what a master teacher that he could just come up with this. And that's true. I don't want to devalue that truth, but he was the Son of God. Who is eternal and has seen some things. So no doubt that helped him with some parables. Yeah, go ahead, Otto.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's one of the things. And parables, usually you don't have specific individuals referenced. So that would be one reason why a lot of scholars say this is not a parable. It's just a story that he has put up. You know, but again, at the end of the day, it doesn't. I wouldn't even take this much time talking about it if I wasn't trying to ramble so the class would come to an end. Because look, we only got 30 seconds or so left. I don't really want to get into it so deeply. But again, scholars have argued about it for years. Does it matter? Not so much. It's teaching. Can we all agree? It's teaching truth. That's the most important thing. And the truth is powerful and very important to us with regard to this. So there was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even the dogs came and licked his sores. So you have two individuals in a totally different life experience. One forced to beg, and the other who obviously is very wealthy. Now, we'll pick this up next week, but neither one of those things have anything to do with the condition of their soul. Doesn't matter if you're a beggar, that deep into poverty, or you're the richest man on earth. That's not going to determine whether you go to heaven or end up in hell. And we need to get that in our minds as we go through this parable, which we'll do on next week.